Hi everyone, welcome to Baby Steps Nutrition, a podcast that focuses on nutrition, health, and wellness for families of children of all ages and stages. I'm your host, Argavon Neil Forouche, a pediatric dietitian and mom of two young children. My goal is to bring you impactful information that you can apply every day in a simplified, practical form to make life easier. Now let's get into today's conversation. When we talk about health and wellness, how often do we include a conversation about hormonal health? Especially with teens and young adults, we should be educating and empowering them with understanding their bodies, what could be impacting their health, and offering tools and strategies to feel their best selves. Dr. Nat Kringoudis is a Chinese medicine practitioner, natural fertility expert, best-selling author, speaker, and the founder of Melbourne Women's Health Clinic called the Pagoda Tree. In her words, fertility is so much more than making babies. Welcome, Nat. I'm so excited for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
And as we know, this is such a sensitive yet important topic, but I'm glad that you're here to shed some light.
Well, I'm excited to be here and I love to talk about all things to do with, you know, our health and like you just touched on, not just from the time that we want to have children, but how can we educate our children and then beyond that? So, you know, we never stop learning, do we?
No, we don't. And as we know, there's also this overwhelm because we are exposed to too much information, right? So there's the benefits of online and the benefits of having accessibility to information. But I always, and as a parent and as a practitioner myself, I'm always overwhelmed and feel frustrated by how much noise that we have to filter through.
Yeah, totally. And I think also the other difficult thing is it's easy to see as an outsider what's going on in other people's lives and be able to support them and help them. But when it comes to our own little box that we live in sometimes, it's very difficult to be objective ourselves. So having the right information and also really working out what is the right information for you, it doesn't have to be overwhelming if you have the tools, but there's a lot to be said for intuition in the mix of everything because there's just not one way. It's just your way. And how can you do that with as much ease as possible?
Absolutely. And you and I both know as parents, you know, parents have the best intention, right? We want to do the best for our children. We want to do the best by our children. But when we feel overwhelmed, sometimes it backfires or we feel frustrated and we start the blaming and shaming game.
Yeah,
but this is where I think knowledge is really power, but the right knowledge, right? We don't want just any knowledge, but we want knowledge that actually works, that's practical, that's impactful. Because I know we all need that in our everyday lives.
Absolutely. And we just want to work smarter and not harder, right? Like it's hard enough as
yes.
It is. So how do we make it simple?
Absolutely. I'd love to talk about the backstory to how you became a fertility expert. Like what led you here and why is your passion using natural methods to help women?
I'd love to share that with you. Thank you for asking. I joke because a lot of people have a story. They have their story of whether it was fertility challenges or they had endometriosis or PCOS or whatever it might be. And I didn't have any of that. I mean, looking back, I did have horrible periods and I didn't associate that with anything other than being a woman. That's what my mum had always said to me, it's horrible to be a woman and I'm sorry that you have painful periods. But that's kind of where that ended. It wasn't until I opened up my practice that I was inundated with women who wanted help with their cycles. And truthfully, I mean, I'd studied and at length. I'd at this point in time had 3 degrees under my belt, but I still didn't feel equipped to help them. And you know, the reason that that was is they were presenting with symptoms that were, what I figured out over time, were a direct correlation to modern day living. But, you know, we're talking nearly 20 years ago, science and medicine hadn't made that correlation yet between our, you know, the stresses within our world, in our environment, in our immediate environment, in our internal environment, and the correlation and connection that had to our reproductive health. So, truthfully, I had this influx of women and I didn't even know what to do with them. And I was very honest in saying, I don't know actually how to help you. This is not what I learned. And so over time, I asked for permission to treat these women. I said, can I help you? I don't really know what I'm going to do, but let's work this out together. And we got very busy very quickly as a result of that, because we started having outstanding results and got very well, became very well known for fertility. So I never chose fertility. Like I said, it kind of chose me. But when I was writing my first published book, I had this epiphany. I'm like, I'm writing to these 30-something year olds about their fertility and their hormones and their reproductive health. What happens if we actually reached out to them and captivated them at the onset of their issues, or even before that? Perhaps we could help young women understand their bodies. Perhaps we could help them look at the body wisdom of their mother and circle back and help them understand what that means for them. And so that really, in more recent times, has taken me on a path to, you know, helping women from puberty and beyond right through until perimenopause and menopause. So, you know, it's not niche, it's women's health, but I feel like after 20 years in the industry, I've got a lot to give, but I've also got a lot to still learn. So I love sharing what I have learned and helping women to just make smarter choices so that they don't have to be confused, so that they actually are informed and can make those great decisions for their future health.
I love that. And I love that you talk about healthcare in terms of a partnership. And I think this is where most people feel very frustrated with the healthcare system, because they feel like they're not being understood or they're sharing certain concerns, but it often can go dismissed. And it might be that the practitioner just isn't aware or doesn't have that knowledge, but they do feel like they're, you know, either being dismissed or they're, you know, sort of downsizing the problems that they're feeling. And I think that's the big takeaway here, is like, it is a partnership and you do need to ask those questions and you need to, it is teamwork, right? You know, they say teamwork makes the dream work. But without that, I feel like it's very limited. And if you want to make those lifelong impacts, you do have to work together. Mm-hmm. And it's a constant process, like you said. Both everybody's growing in that partnership.
Well, I mean, anybody who's a business owner, let's say, you know, you're constantly evaluating what's working and what's not. You know, you're constantly looking at where the improvements can be made, and we have to continue to do that. And that's what makes a business successful. Your body isn't any different. We need to be constantly evaluating, which can feel overwhelming. But if you understand the different phases and stages of you as a woman as one aspect, and then you within your cycles as a woman as well, then you can really have some wisdom, and you can continue to evaluate according to those two things. Where am I in my cycle and what phase of life am I in? Am I in puberty? Am I in my fertile years? Am I in perimenopausal? You know, so having that wisdom, it really actually takes a lot of the guesswork out of it. And your body's always speaking to you all the time, every day. It's just a matter of being able to decode what that actually is for you.
Yes. And speaking of wisdom, this is why we're having this conversation. And so let's go back to young children and puberty, because I know that's a hot topic. I have a 10 and a half year old daughter. So clearly we're definitely entering that phase. And there are other peers of hers that have entered it sooner. And I know a lot of caregivers are very concerned. And so let's just start there. What are some myths and misconceptions about children and puberty?
I think the first thing, actually, even before that, I want to raise is, you know, having a continual conversation with our children around puberty. We ourselves, personally, I'm not sure about you, but my mother waited until I was a certain age to start to talk about.
Yes.
And I think that's the one big thing that I feel like we failed our generation with. And it's not her fault. It's just what was done at the time. That's what she learned. And it was a taboo subject and nobody talked about it. And so, no different to having to wipe your bottom when you go to the toilet or blow your nose if that's something that you need to do. I think that talking about and helping kids understand the phases and stages is really important. And rather than what we've always done is either shy away from the subject or lie to our children, we can actually have these conversations that are age appropriate at the time that our children are asking. And so that very first time that your child comes to you and says, "Mum, where did I come from?" is a beautiful opportunity for you to have an honest and open conversation. You don't need to go into the details. Most kids would ask this age at around, I don't know, 3 to 5 years of age, let's say. And everyone's different and that's fine. But having that conversation, it's simple as, well, actually, dad has sperm and mum has an egg inside of her, and that sperm and egg get together and that's conception and that's what becomes a baby, rather than, oh, the stork dropped you off on the doorstep, which is a frightening, actually, if you think about it. I would just flew through the air and landed on the doorstep. Or, you know, the doctor put you in there, which is maybe not untrue for some pregnancies that are assisted conception, but I still think having these conversations about the evolution of us as a tiny human is really important. And then that conversation gets to evolve organically over many, many years. So by the time puberty does arrive, when it's not scary, it's just part of what happens next. It's not this mystery. It's not this taboo topic. And I understand that not everybody's feels equipped or comfortable to talk about that. That's because we didn't get the information. So we have a real opportunity, I think, as parents to change this conversation in a great way. We also have an emotional experience generally related to, you know, intimate times that we've spent with somebody or our partner or the father of our child. So, you know, your child doesn't have that. And so you don't need to worry about that. Serving them and sharing with them the facts is all they need. And that's all that needs to be spoken about. Kids don't have that emotional attachment. So they kind of shrug their shoulders and go, oh, that makes sense. And they move on. So that's, I think, really important just to set the stage before we go into some of the myths around puberty. Because that to me is a missing conversation for many people. And I think we need to start there so that by the time that we get to puberty, there aren't that many myths left. We have, and you know, there's all sorts of things that people will say based on their own personal experience or based on what they were told by their parents or mother growing up. So, you know, I think the main thing to understand is puberty, the onset of puberty typically, the average age was around 13, and we're seeing now children as young as 11 being the average age, I should say, you know, going through puberty, and that's really marked by, you know, your first period. But what I've seen a lot of is premature or precocious puberty where children are showing signs of early development, and that can happen from a really young age, and I'm seeing more and more of that, and that's concerning to me. So that's a conversation that I think we need to be aware of, because there's many factors that seem to be activating a child's adrenals well before they're ready to then present and start to instigate that process of puberty happening. And there's lots we can do to slow that down. So, you know, I mean, in terms of the myths, I guess it's not a myth, but I think that most people expect it to start at the early teen years, and that's not actually the case anymore. We're seeing it start earlier than ever before. And that would be probably the number one myth that I see is that, you know, you're 13 or 14 and you get your period and it doesn't go like that. And then the other side of that is some women don't get their period or young girls don't get their period until they're 16 or 17. It doesn't mean necessarily that there's something wrong with them, but we do need to explore why that might be. So I think the main things we see is, you know, girls get their period at 13, they smack bang have a regular cycle, and it's like you think yours is now, and it's not. It's so different. If you remember back to when, if you actually accurately remember, periods weren't regular. They were all over the place. You know, there was a whole lot of symptoms that came with that. And again, using those as clues, I think, is really important for our long-term health.
Yeah, and you brought up a really good point about being that safe space for your kids to ask questions. And like you said, a lot of us grew up in a generation where it was either tabooed or just the parents didn't lack the knowledge, or they were also embarrassed or scared to talk about a topic, or really puberty was more associated with intercourse and reproduction, right? So nobody ever talked about it in the sense of growth and development. And so I think what's scary now is the fact that kids have access to technology.
Absolutely.
And I know that's a big fear of, if you're not the person that your kids are asking, then they will possibly resort to, you know, Google or browsers or their friends who may have access to the internet. And so then we know that's not a good thing because
that's a slippery slope.
Right.
That's so a real slippery slope.
I think that in itself, and I know for someone like myself, is a big enough motivation to just stay curious and be open-minded to those questions, because I don't want my kids to go elsewhere to get those answers.
The other thing too, I think, is that we have such an amazing opportunity to be the example for our children. And whilst we might see this in other areas, are we thinking about it when it comes to our health? And it's not just what they see us put in our mouth. It's what we say. If you have problematic periods and you have complained about your menstrual cycle for as long as you can remember, but not done anything about it, or maybe not even realized that that's actually treatable, maybe you didn't even know that, then why would our daughters want to get their period? Like, you know,
right.
It starts with us being that example, speaking positively about ourselves and our bodies, being able to utilize our cycles as our inner wisdom and that window into our internal environment. And so I think we have to catch ourselves and really think about, how are we talking about our health as a woman? How are we showing up for them, and what sort of example are we leading? And that's great motivation for us to do better, but it's also amazing for them to see us embrace that, so that they are led to do that. Now, it's the rite of passage for teenagers to go against whatever we tell them to do. That's just the way it goes, right? But I think right. But I think what you're doing is you're creating their home base, and their home base is what feels safe. And we generally come back to home base. So I love to tell the story of, you know, I grew up in a very healthy household. There was a lot of fresh food. It was always, my mother was very dedicated to making sure that we were well nourished. And when I moved away to study at a university level, which is what everybody did when I grew up in a country town, I lived around the corner from Kentucky Fried Chicken, and I was like, oh, this is the best thing ever. I probably ate KFC for lunch every day for at least a year, and I made no association to what that did to my body, amongst other things. You know, I'm a new uni student. I'm burning the candle at both ends. I'm eating things. I'm drinking things. I'm doing things I shouldn't necessarily be doing. And again, rite of passage. But, one day I had this overwhelming feeling that I just felt horrible in my skin. When I say my skin, I mean my body. To that, I had acne. My periods were awful. I'd gained considerable amount of weight. And just every day didn't feel nice. And so I decided to do something about it. What did I do? I took myself to home base. I went back to what I knew that I had seen and I had learned to be what I needed to do to be healthy. I didn't tell anyone. I certainly wasn't going to tell my mother, because that would be like admitting fault. But I did that quietly and put myself back into a position where my body could recover. And so, you know, she created that home base for me, probably not aware that that's what she was doing. And that has gone on to be that for both myself and even my sister, who obviously we grew up in the same household. So don't underestimate the power of the home base that you are creating for your family and your children, because, you know, monkey see, monkey do, and they will at some point, I believe, when they are feeling overwhelmed or in a state of crisis, this is what feels safe to them. So this is what they'll come back to.
I love that. And speaking of home base, I have friends who you could say they're women's health advocates, but they're also just moms of boys. And I love to hear that they're having those conversations with their sons about what periods look like and, you know, what women's bodies go through, so that when they, you know, see another girl in their classroom who's going through puberty, it doesn't become, you know, a taboo subject or a topic of shame, but the son is already well aware of, well, this is something that my mom goes through as well. Mm-hmm. And it's more about acceptance. And I love hearing that now. So like you said, the narrative is definitely changing.
100%.
And it's going 100%. In the right direction.
And we don't, you know, my son is 10 and my daughter is 14. We don't necessarily sit them down together to have these conversations. These are just conversations that occur whilst I might be chopping vegetables, or Livia's had a bad day at school, or she wants to tell me something, and he'll just be within an earshot. So it's not a specific conversation to him, but I don't hide it. and we have that conversation. So I don't think that he knows deeply what goes on, but he knows, and he knows enough. And when he's ready to ask the question, he will. His kids are curious by nature anyway. So I trust that at that point in time, he will, if he needs more information, ask the question. But for now, just it happening and nothing being hidden, I think is you know, if you're not sure where to start, that's a great place to start.
I love that. And also, like in my family, my children, there's a boy and a girl. So I think naturally there's going to be that exposure to someone of the opposite sex.
Yes, definitely.
So those conversations started even earlier than I would have been ready to have.
Yeah. So good.
And Nat, you mentioned about precocious puberty, and I think this is another important topic because, again, it's something I hear about all the time. And that basically, for the listeners, means that girls are having their periods sooner than ever before. In your professional experience, why are we seeing this trend? And when do you advise that caregivers should seek professional evaluation?
Yeah, really interesting. So typically what happens is you'll start to see a couple of things, potentially body odor, maybe some pubic hair or some underarm hair. And that can happen. I've had patients as early as 3 or 4 years of age start to see that. Now, I would always say to rule out anything else that might be going on. So you definitely want to seek the help of your doctor or specialist at that point, just to see what might be going on. Because there are some things that can instigate that can be, have a need to treat quite quickly. That hasn't been my experience. For the patients that I see, that's been ruled out. So any sort of pituitary issues or other factors that might be involved, I get the patients that it's always, well, there's no reason why this is happening, so that's fine to go and seek, you know, alternative treatments. In my observation, what I've noticed, and I actually think there needs to be far more research done in this area, and I think it's something we're going to see a lot of in the next couple of years, is that there seems to be some type of major stress event that triggers that to happen within a child. So whether it might be a family split by the way of a divorce or a separation, a loss of a parent, or, you know, maybe some type of traumatic abuse, whatever that event has been seems to trigger this for kids that are actually probably already susceptible. So maybe, you know, maybe that's just part of their genetic makeup as well. But I've seen and been able to correlate it back to always, every time with a child, a traumatic experience that has activated the adrenals. And, you know, we wait, what happens normally is we start to see slow development, and these things start to happen as kids get older. 8, 9, 10 is the time that we would typically start to see some body odor, pubic hair, breast buds grow, and usually a period arrives within a year. For children with precocious puberty, that can be something that happens, but there is often this early onset of the period. We're not seeing children 2 and 3 years of age get a period, don't get me wrong, but these symptoms tend to continue, and they're not necessarily problematic. It doesn't mean that you're going to have an early period or early menopause even, but it does, you know, it can be quite stressful for a parent to watch this happen. And so, yeah, the adrenals are activated earlier than what they should be by way of what the average and the normal is. And so we are seeing precocious puberty, and it is stressful for parents. So yes, we want to actually look at why, and we need to treat the why, not just the symptoms of that. You can't really treat pubic hair other than waxing, you know. So we want to have a look at why that's actually happening and see if you can slow a lot of this down. And in my experience, there's so much you can do, and it works very, very effectively. But to me also, this is just another way of the body telling you what's actually going on. And when we can listen to that and use those symptoms as clues, rather than fear them, we can embrace them, then we can work out the next step. So it's just another thing that we're seeing. But I do wonder what the last 2 years, what sort of impact that's going to have on our children when it comes to puberty. So I thank you for asking this question, because I think we just need to have that awareness and it on our radar, so that if that was to happen in our family, we don't need to necessarily be overwhelmed and very stressed out by it, but we can do things to actually support our children in the right way.
That's so interesting. And especially the fact that, because this is something I think about all the time, exactly how the past 2 years have really magnified any existing conditions or challenges. And we've certainly heard a lot about, you know, depression, mental health. Mm-hmm. But then now, are we having that conversation about physical health? And it's so interesting that you brought that up, because then you're right. Like, you go back to thinking about stress levels, and if kids, especially those, have really internalized their stress, you know, a lot of children may act out, but a lot of children are more quiet and timid. And so, or they're dealing with all kinds of situations in their household and they're remaining quiet, but then maybe it's manifesting itself in some sort of symptoms. And in this case, it could be early puberty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so really interesting stuff. I agree that we need to pay attention.
Absolutely. And that's the thing, you know, we don't know what we don't know, but we can suspect that things are going to happen, and we can prepare ourselves for that as well.
Absolutely. And so important to talk about. Speaking of the last 2 years, you know, there are a lot of studies now, a lot of headline news talking about the COVID-19 infection and its connection to the hormonal cycles, and a lot of women anecdotally reporting that they're having missed periods or irregular periods, and maybe linking that to possible long haul COVID. What has been your experience in that?
Yeah, this is really interesting, and I've dived deep into this area personally for patients as well as myself. We also had the privilege, we got COVID when no one had COVID in Australia, so we were very public about the fact that we had COVID, and what that did was it just meant that when it started to circulate and other people got it, they came to us to ask the questions. So I ended up doing a lot of support when it came to supporting people through their experience with COVID. But then what that meant was also the other side of it. I'm now looking at the ongoing impact that has had on women's health. What we definitely know is that COVID and long COVID tends to, there's sort of five main contributing factors to long COVID. So you can't have long COVID without having COVID. We definitely know in the short term, COVID does have a temporary inflammatory response on the reproductive organs. So this is why women have reported heavier bleeding, or maybe a bleed out of the ordinary, maybe spotting, you name it, whatever variation that a woman has seen in her period post virus, you can probably blame on COVID. That shouldn't last for more than 2 to 3 cycles for most women. So we can then safely say if there's an ongoing challenge, there's 5 main contributing factors to that. And the main one we look at, or the main two we look at for women, would be increased inflammation and ongoing inflammation in the body, and also reactivation of a previous autoimmune condition. So whilst endometriosis isn't necessarily categorized as autoimmune, we treat it as such. So seeing a lot of flare-ups with things like endometriosis, acne, and painful periods and heavy bleeding especially. So, and that's because of the nature of what it's doing within the body. The other three things just to mention in terms of long COVID that aren't necessarily related are slow recovery or not non-recovery from the virus, ongoing respiratory challenges, and ongoing circulatory system challenges. So, you know, when you put all that together, for many of us, and this is me included, I'm a perfect candidate. I have a history of autoimmune. So, you know, looking at what's happened now and how my body's changed and what I need to do to put it back to, or bring it back to, that state of balance is different to what I had to do prior to. And a lot of women also are complaining about they had their Hashimoto's or they had their endometriosis or whatever it might be under control to a point where it wasn't impacting their day-to-day life, and all of a sudden they kind of feel like they're back where they started from. So, you know, we're seeing that reactivation, which is quite overwhelming for people. But again, we know why. So if we know why, we can actually then put steps in place to help manage that and get the body back into that state of recovery once again.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of those conditions you mentioned, like PCOS, for example, endometriosis, and a lot of the other issues really are tied to inflammation.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
Yeah,
and so absolutely. With COVID, I mean, obviously,
yeah,
more inflammation.
Yeah, I mean, look, fundamentally these things are genetic, right? But that doesn't mean that they have to present for you. Our genes will actually play the game depending on what environment you put them in. So we can either present with symptoms or problems or challenges or not. And that's very much the environment that you put yourself in, whether that's the external environment, the internal environment, and the mental environment. So there's things that we can do to move our body into a state where it's not a problem. But if you are basically ticking all the boxes and putting your body into the most inflammatory state that you can, then you're going to see a lot of these things and these symptoms turned on. So our job is to try and identify what they are and turn off the instigators so that you can live without evidence of that problem.
Absolutely. And for the listeners, how can they tell the difference between a normal and abnormal inflammation? And how can we heal the gut? Some kind of more general guidelines.
Sure. I mean, inflammation fundamentally is wherever there's pain, there's inflammation. So if you're wondering, well, do I have inflammation or do you have pain in your body? It doesn't have to be period pain. It could be headache. It could be ovulation pain. It could be stomach pain. It could be shoulder pain. So it's not necessarily just the reproductive organs that we're talking about. So looking at where your pain might be, if you're wondering if that's hormonal, well, ask yourself, is the pain cyclic? Does it come at the same time every month? That's one way of understanding if your hormones are at play. But to be more general, I mean, inflammation starts within the gut. And when our gut is compromised, and stress alone can compromise our gut integrity. So that is, you know, the actual what's in our gut. So the viruses, the bacteria, the food, the everything that's in there. Can be influenced, and you want good bacteria, and it's not bad to have viruses. Our body deals with those things, but when the actual gut integrity, that's the gut wall, is compromised and things leak out of the gut, so to speak, leaky gut. So when you've got viruses or bacteria or food even moving outside of the digestive system, that's problematic. It's not supposed to be out there, and your body understands that as something that's not supposed to be there. So it'll go looking at ways of addressing that. And that's, you know, where we often see this activation of autoimmune or an autoimmune response in response to inflammation. So, you know, what do you do about that? I think really looking at how you can minimize inflammation and put your body in the most anti-inflammatory state possible. And that's not done necessarily with anti-inflammatory medication. That's done with reducing inflammatory foods, being aware of stress and managing stress, making sure you're eating, anti-inflammatory, foods that support that. So the inflammatory foods that we want to get rid of are the sugar, the gluten, the dairy. Unfortunately, they're all the good things. They're all the things that we could eat all day, every day. But they are difficult to digest. They are problematic. They can be abrasive. They can upset the gut microbiome. And so we want to minimize those to reduce inflammation as a starting point. There's many other things that you can do, but if you haven't started there, then that's the first place to start. And then looking at how you can support gut with pre and probiotics as a starting point as well is a very safe place to start. When if you were to start to reduce the inflammatory foods and start to just even introduce a pre and probiotic, you do that very slowly just to make sure that your body doesn't have a crazy response, because that's the other thing we're seeing. A lot of women who have been subject to the last 2 years flare as a result of their treatment. So we have to just go very slowly. Less is best, less is more. But that's a really great and safe place to generally start.
Okay, so it's listen to your body. So any sort of pain, any rash, any acne, right? Abnormal
any
bleeding.
Any changes. Don't second guess a change. It's not in your head. If there's something that's different, then explore it. We're getting told so often things are in our head as women, and that's not acceptable anymore. You're not imagining your symptoms. They are there if you feel them. So let's explore them, whatever that might be.
Right. And sometimes if things don't have a label or a diagnosis, people think like it shouldn't exist or it doesn't exist, but it absolutely could.
Oh,
it
yes.
just hasn't been addressed.
That's right. Yeah, 100%.
And let's talk about another hot topic, which is birth control. We know a lot of women are on it. We know a lot of kids start sooner than they would like for various reasons. In your opinion, what are some do's and don'ts when it comes to who should be prescribed it? And what should the public know about duration of use, possible symptoms, any caveats related to being on birth control?
I think the biggest thing about birth control is, what are you using it for? Are you using it for contraception? Because that's one conversation, and that's something that should be an informed decision, and every woman should have the right to choose that. If you're using it to manage symptoms, is a completely different conversation, and it's often the go-to, so often the go-to, especially for young women, to manage everything from PCOS, period pain, acne, mood swings, you name it. We use it to manage anything to do with the cycle. Now, I think the challenge here is that and it's such a disservice to women if we're just providing them a pill packet and not actually looking at the reason why they have the gnarly symptoms that they have, then they can go years and years and years with an undiagnosed underlying hormone imbalance simply because they were provided the pill as a 14-year-old and no more or no further investigation happened. It's not your doctor's fault. That's the tools that they have. And sometimes we're seeing our doctor for something we probably should see our gynecologist or someone that specializes in hormones for. They have a better knowledge and understanding and have probably seen thousands and thousands of women or young women in the same position. The other thing I want mothers to understand is that the age that you start to take the pill, so if your daughter is 14 and you start to use the pill at 14, it halts her sexual hormone maturation. So her sex hormones, our sex hormones don't mature until around the age of 21. So if you're using the pill from the age of 14, you're halting that process and that development at 14. And so let's say that this same girl comes off the pill when she's 26. Her sex hormones are as mature as her 14-year-old self. So she's still got to go through that process. And this is why a lot of girls or a lot of women come off the pill in their late 20s, early 30s, and they're like, not only did their symptoms come rushing back, but they're often worse, and then their periods are still missing or their periods are still problematic. So I'm not saying don't utilize the pill in these scenarios. I'm saying know this information, look into the imbalance. If you need to use birth control to give yourself some space and some time to think and to collect, you know, what you need to do, then, and that's a decision you make, then great. But then let's still fix the underlying imbalance whilst we're doing that. And so that we can then allow the body to mature and develop in the way it should. This is going to help with a lot of long-term fertility challenges, because it's not that a woman is infertile, it's that the body hasn't had the opportunity to mature, and then we've got to fix the unbalance at the same time. And that's just stressful as a woman that, say, comes off the pill in her 30s and decides she wants children, only to find out she's got a whole lot of work to do before she's actually in a position to have children. And women aren't told this. So this is a very important conversation to have. And also, you know, the pill can't fix the problem. And that's the other misconception. Women are led to believe that they're having a period on the pill, which they're not. They're having a bleed. You don't ovulate whilst you're on the pill. It's designed to flatline your hormones. As women, we feel different every single day of our cycle because our hormones are in a different position every single day of our cycle. But when you're on the pill, there's no different position. It's just the same. So it alters our senses. It alters the chemical reactions that are happening within our bodies. And whilst that can sound fabulous, over time, a lot of women will actually report that they just don't feel like themselves anymore. That's actually the number one thing women will say to me when they transition off the pill. I didn't know what it was like to feel like me, and I'm never going back there again. So, you know, again, if you're 14 when you begin on the pill, you don't even know who you are as a 14-year-old. So put the pill in the mix and you're really not going to know who you are for a very long time. And this is just, unfortunately, it's just a side effect of the pill that we can't do anything about. So I think it's just about having all of that information, piecing it together, working out what is right for you and making that informed choice. If it is right for you, then let's support your body whilst you're on it. There's many things you can do to support your body. And if it's not actually fixing a problem, well, then let's look at how we can lead your body back to that state so that you can be fertile at any age or phase. And like you said at the beginning, fertility is not about pregnancy. Fertility is a state of being. It's a state of health. So, you know, we associate fertility with pregnancy because that's what society has conditioned us to think about. But fertility is just a thriving reproductive system.
Yeah. And I think initially when people go to the doctor, they want a short-term solution for whatever issues that they're having, and the doctor will prescribe a, you know, an oral contraceptive or a patch or an IUD, but they're not really meant to be used long term. But so many women, and I've been in that position, ended up using it for like, say, 20 years, because it depends on the age at which you started, or, you know, the age at which you want to stop if you choose to conceive. And so it ends up being years, like 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. And I think that's the problematic side of these, is that it ends up being used far too long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we're not prescribing it going, what's the exit strategy, are we, you know?
Right.
And the same with something like the marina as well. Like, what's the exit strategy? How long is this here for? Mm-hmm. What's the plan? So often we don't plan this. So we really do need to think about the long-term plan as well.
Right. And so that brings me to this other conversation about, so women who are either don't want children later in life, or they're, you know, they're done having children, but they're apprehensive about these birth control methods. And I know they're very widely available. They're very widely prescribed to women, but I think there are conversations, and I've been part of that, where there are some concerns, some questions. What is your advice there? And are there other natural methods to prevent pregnancy?
I think the biggest gift you can give to a woman is her understanding her cycle and her body. And it's not that difficult. It's just that we haven't been taught properly. So utilizing and watching several menstrual cycles to really decode what's actually happening when you have, obviously, your period's very obvious, but when you're ovulating in that fertile window, teaching women to understand that is extremely empowering. And you can do what you want with that information. You can either put yourself in a position for pregnancy, or you cannot. And the choice is yours. Mm-hmm. If you don't know when your fertile window is, and, you know, in a person that's got a regular healthy cycle, you're only generally fertile for 3 to 5 days, let's say. And that's being conservative, as in, you know, generous. So understanding this and looking at fertility awareness as a means of health is very important. The fertility awareness method gets a terrible rap from the medical profession. Many women will say, I've gone to my doctor and said, I use fertility awareness, and that's just literally being aware of your cycle and understanding when you're ovulating. And, you know, they'll get laughed at. And to me, it's so degrading to think that a woman couldn't understand her body and couldn't actually figure that out. And I've practiced fertility awareness for 20 plus years. I've got 2 children. They were conceived the month that I tried. I don't say this because I think I'm a hero. I say this because, you know, the other side of the coin is I can also use this information if I don't want to have any more children. And let me tell you, I don't want to have any more children, and my youngest is 10. And so, you know, these methods work. It's just a matter of you understanding your fertile window and your non-fertile window and being empowered to use that information. I'm at the other side of the scale where I look at my body and what it's telling me every day, whether I am fertile or whether I'm not, and I'm blown away. I'm like, how can women not actually know this? To me, it's so obvious. And for me to, you know, have an accident, in inverted commas, I would probably have to be blind drunk and out of it to that to happen, because it's just, to me, so clear when I'm actually fertile. So, you know, I think teaching young girls this, and then, you know, like I said, they're going to make decisions based on what they've seen at home. They're going to make decisions based on, obviously, what their peers are doing as well. There are also other tracking devices that are extremely accurate that allow you to track your cycle in a way that you can really know when you're fertile and when you're not as well. And again, using fertility awareness, it's a nice backup plan. If you don't trust yourself, using a device, and that's not an app. I don't advocate for you using an app. An app will guess when your next period is due, which can be a disaster. But something that you're inputting data into, that's also not only just recording your symptoms, but it's also recording your basal body temperature to track this. So, you know, I'm a big fan of the Daisy, but there are other devices out there as well that you can utilize that have extremely high accuracy rates that you can then rely on if you are one of those women that feel you don't quite feel like you have the confidence yet, but you want to learn what your body's telling you and grow your confidence along the way.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like the underlying theme is to take the guesswork out of it.
Absolutely.
So when you track it, you have it right there, and you can look at patterns, right?
Totally. But I think, again, that's something we've learned from our mother. Like, I don't trust myself. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm like, well, if you can't trust yourself, who the heck can you trust? Like, literally right. The only person you can trust is yourself. So, you know, this information is very important.
Yes. And also something, you know, being a healthcare practitioner is like, we always tell people, if you have it in writing, some kind of documentation, it's so much easier to work with than just showing up and guessing, or, you know, it's verbatim, or last month was this, 6 months ago was that.
Yeah.
And that just makes it so much harder. So the more you have mm-hmm. it written down, the easier it is to
work with. Oh,
yeah.
Even if
with.
That's where you start and you're just writing down when your period has arrived each month, that's empowering as a starting point. If we don't write it down, we forget. We look and go, oh, my gosh, did I ovulate? Didn't I ovulate? Where am I? This is confusing. And so I highly recommend that we are constantly documenting this, definitely.
Yeah, and part of that awareness, even for teens, young girls to start, are like, there are things like period journals, right, where they can start mm-hmm. writing things down, their feelings, their symptoms related to – you know, that
absolutely.
Time of month.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, my latest book, Beautiful You, which is available on Amazon, I go through all of this, and there's opportunity to track and learn how to track your cycle in there as well. It's targeted at 14 plus young women, and it's a resource that I wrote. It's the book I wish I had when I was 14.
Yes. Yeah. And I want to include all of that in the show notes so that the listeners can easily access it.
Amazing.
Annette, where else can our listeners find out more about you? I know you're doing so many other things, so I'd love to share that with our listeners
as well. Of course,
well.
Thank you. I mean, we're always creating content and information for women. I kind of want to get to the point where I'm irrelevant in women's lives, because we've taught them so much about themselves that they don't really need us anymore. But I will say that I'm a mad fan of Instagram. So I hang out on Instagram. I answer people's questions on Instagram. I'm always going live on Instagram. So it's Nat Kringoutis at Instagram. And then also all of our resources can either be found, always check out my bio there, but my website is also natkringoutis.com, and there's a whole lot, there's years and years and years worth of information over there as well that might be useful for women to you know, start to get clued up on things. And I'd encourage you, if you don't know where to start, I have, if you head over to my website, you'll see that there's a hormone quiz. So if you're curious about what your hormones are doing and you're not quite sure, you can go ahead and fill in the hormone quiz. It'll help you to kind of lead you in a direction of what to do next, or where to start to look and be more curious about what your symptoms are telling you.
Wonderful. It's a great place to start. Absolutely. And I will include that as well.
Amazing.
Nat, I want to really thank you so much for being here, sharing all this valuable information. I think the big takeaway here is that it is so important to educate and empower women so that they can feel more in control of their own health.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for opening up that conversation. And I think, like I said, it's about educating our young girls so that they've got this information. They don't have to feel like we did, like we felt like we were in the dark and it was very lonely. They can feel yes. like they've got a team of really strong women around them to support them.
I love that. And I love your empathetic and balanced approach. I know, as a parent, you know, just taking that lighter but more open-minded conversation to something as sensitive as this topic is really empowering and important. So thank you so much for that.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
And to the listeners, thank you as always for tuning in. Until next time. Thank you for listening to the Baby Steps Nutrition Podcast with your host, Argavan Nilforush. We hope you enjoyed our deep dive into all the tips and tricks you and your family can use to make daily life a little easier. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please leave a rating and review, share with others, and follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Baby Steps Nutrition Podcast. As always, you can head over to babystepsnutrition.com to sign up for our email list, as well as check out all the links and resources in the show notes. See you next time. Tune in. Feel great.